You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Shane McRae. Shane, thanks so much for talking with me today.
Thank you for having me.
Let's talk about what you're working on now. I imagine it's a few different things, but or other activities, but we didn't talk about that beforehand. So what are you working on at the moment?
I guess it is a couple different things. You know, I'm looking at edits. I'm looking at my next finished manuscript, which is called The Gilded Auction Block, and I'm also writing new poems. And I don't, you know, I'm not entirely sure what they're going to end up being, except I know presumably they're not about Donald Trump, just because pretty much everything in my next manuscript is, and by the time I was done with that, I got really sick of writing about Donald Trump, and so the new things that I've been working on, the very new things, have had, as far as I can tell, nothing to do with him.
And the Gilded Auction Block, is that about Trump as well?
Yes, that's the next. That's the one that is about Trump. Yeah, that's all about Trump.
All right. So that's being finished now.
It's finished in a sense, but I'm always looking until the last second when I can't. I'm always looking to edit things.
And so what? I think we should talk a little bit about maybe just the aftermath of writing something like that. Part of this whole interview series, you know, is that in some ways it takes place within the course of history. So, you know, artists in many ways are reacting to and also not wanting to talk about Trump, because that seems to be kind of one of his strengths is getting himself talked about. It's interesting that how you frame that work, and also that it's kind of like a hard job that you don't want to do anymore, almost. So to just reflect on that without getting into the content too much, but The Gilded Auction Block, after doing all that and not wanting to talk about him anymore, how do you feel about the fact that, you know, we live in a country with a president like that, and that besides the horrific things that we can, I'm sure, all agree on, he's also fodder for, artists and poets everywhere, as well as activists. I'm just asking, I guess, to reflect on if you can say how you feel about it now that it's done. How do you look on him? Because he is both, muse to you and something horrific, right?
No, there's a couple different ways to respond to that. I mean, I wouldn't want to give the impression, which I fear that I did, that it's, hard work. I mean, I don't, it's writing poems, which, there's a lot of work in it. I don't know. I mean, when I think of hard work, I think of, when I worked in a factory for a little while, or people who work in factories for a lot longer, all different kinds of hard work. But it's definitely real work. It's just not hard the way I think of hard. I guess I think of it as physically hard.
Well, not physically hard. I think I meant hard in the sense that it was it's a subject that's upsetting, It's upset many people, the fact that he keeps appearing in the news. It's triggering. It's all of these things we hear about. So I meant hard work in terms of it being psychologically difficult material.
I guess there's a way of thinking of Trump as a sort of muse-like figure, although I'm not sure that I want to. He's a weird... I don't know what it's like to have a president like Trump, I guess. I mean, it's like a lot of things. For one thing, time seems to have become very different, or it seems very different now from the way that it used to seem. Every time that I'm reminded, or that I might manage to remind myself that Trump has been president for a year, I am surprised anew. It doesn't seem possible. It still seems, I still feel at least caught in the very first moments of right, you know, immediately following the election. I guess the thing that I've been thinking about a lot, although I don't want to phrase it in the wrong way and suggest something that I don't want to suggest. The thing that I've been thinking about a lot is, like, I've read some of the poems from the Gilded Auction Block and a few different things, and a few times people have commented about how, you know, I'm talking about Trump directly, and I guess they've expressed a certain degree of surprise or something similar. And I guess I find it, I mean, I guess I sort of expected as part of the reaction, and I don't want to suggest this is like a prescriptive thing, because people can write whatever poems they want, but I sort of suggested to see a lot more poems, maybe I'm just not looking in the right places, that are just directly and apparently responding to the Trump administration, like poems entitled Jeff Sessions and things like that. I'm not seeing a ton of that work, and like I said, I'm probably just looking in the wrong places. There are a lot more oblique things or things that can be taken one way or another, and, you know, poetry should be allowed that room, but I guess I've been surprised to not see as many really, really direct as I would have thought I would. And that's been interesting. What I've seen a lot in the political art, and maybe it's just because this is the way that political art is, although I think there are probably other reasons as well, are like, you know, you'll see a thing and, you know, it can be taken one way or another way, and taken one way, it's sort of a rebuke of what's going on politically, but it's open enough that it's not, you know, just saying, you know, like, line one isn't like Trump is terrible or whatever. And I guess I expected more of that. Line one being Trump is terrible.
Well, I think we probably can expect more of that, you know, since there is so much that, you know, I guess I don't want to say it's just anger that he's generating, but a lot of emotions being generated by his work. So I would imagine, yeah, there would be more of that as well. So I know you're going to read for us today a few things. So I'd love to ask you to read something next and tell us what it is and what it's from.
Sure. So as I said, my new manuscript is called The Gilded Auction Block, which is a line in one of the poems in the manuscript. And as I said, the manuscript in general is about Trump, although I think, I mean, that's both true, but it's also oversimplifying insofar as, I guess, I was thinking of Trump as, I mean, Trump represents some ultimate expression of America, and there are a variety of possible ultimate expressions of America, and Trump is one of them. But I do think that he represents something very true and very real and fundamental about the country that I think a lot of people, I think that fact about Trump upsets a lot of people. So when I was writing Gilded Auction Block, I was trying to think about what it, you know, not only what does Trump do in particular, but what does Trump represent? And so the poem I'm going to read is sort of the first poem that I wrote. Well, yeah, I suppose the first pretty direct poem I wrote, the first poem I wrote in response to something in particular that Trump did in the manuscript. And it's called Everything I Know About Blackness I Learned from Donald Trump. And it has an epigraph, which is something that Donald Trump said. It is, Frederick Douglass is an example of somebody who's done an amazing job and is being recognized more and more, I notice.
Oh, my God, yeah. I remember that so closely, because that was also the, I'm sorry if you were about to say this, but of course, it made it clear that he wasn't sure whether Frederick Douglass was living or dead.
Exactly, yeah. And that was relatively early on. And so that's, you know, I wrote this poem, and then first I thought I couldn't write more like it, and then maybe I did, I don't know. Anyway, everything I learned about blackness, I learned from Donald Trump. America, I was driving when I heard you. Had died, I swerved into a ditch and wept. In the dream, I dreamed unconscious in the ditch. America, I dreamed you climbed from the ditch. You must believe your body is in any body, and stood beside the ditch for 8 years, thinking, except you didn't stand you right away, lay down on your pale belly, and tried to claw your way back to the ditch. You right away began to wail and weep and gnash your teeth. My tears met yours in the ditch, America. They carry me downstream, a slave on the run from you, an Egyptian queen. Even in my dreams, I'm in your dreams.
Yeah, powerful, powerful poem. So of course, in that poem, yeah, as you gave us the insight of, you're talking about Frederick, or where it was a kind of taking off of what Trump said about Frederick Douglass, and also that the poem is also about race and being black. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
And what Trump, and the new context that Trump has created, and all of this, and Black Lives Matter. I mean, all of this is coming together, right?
Well, part of when I've written my earlier books, I've always felt that it would be sort of an act of dishonesty to not, at least in one poem or at one moment, represent sort of, like, if I'm talking about a particular issue, you know, represent the other side of the issue. Although usually when I do so, I'm using the words that the person, somebody on the other side might use against them, you know, without distorting them. But with Trump, and I think that that's sort of a duty that, you know, I owe to the fact that the people on the other side, even if we profoundly disagree with them or disagree with them, are nonetheless dimensional human beings. But there's something about Trump that makes him seem like a comic book character. That's another thing besides the time distortion effect. It's a sort of reality distortion effect. And I don't just mean the sort of like fake news and everybody's lying thing, but I mean an actual, there's a certain sort of one-dimensionalness to Trump and the Trump presidency that seems like something that isn't happening in life, but is happening in a comic book. So when the effect that has on the country in a wider sense is it makes everything else seem like it's happening in a comic book. Like, it's very difficult to have a nuanced reaction to a lot of the things that Donald Trump is doing. When, you know, the poem ends talking about, you know, it essentially gives a vision of what America thinks black people are, and there's a slave on the run, and then there's an Egyptian queen, and these are both obviously, you know, very one-dimensional visions, one-dimensional ideas, but they nonetheless strike me as, you know, they seem to me ways that Donald Trump probably thinks about black people. I don't think that he gives a lot of human dimension to many other people at all. As I said earlier, I was trying to bring in as much of sort of the wider world into these poems, even though they're mostly specifically about Trump. And I think that this sort of seeing other people in monodimensionally is again an expression of a certain way of being American that just happens to be embodied in Trump.
It's so interesting because it's as a poet, you know, the way I think of poetry, it is this as you use the word, nuanced language, right? This, you know, all the but it's so interesting that you're talking about Trump also as this issue and this paradigm and this force almost that's prevented kind of nuanced thinking and writing. People tend to have enormously passionate you know, sort of extreme responses to him. That's kind of fascinating. I'd love to hear another poem. I don't know if it's from the same manuscript or not, but
sure.
If you could read another one, I'd love that.
So this one is more along the lines of the sort of direct poetry that I was talking about. It actually happens to have Jeff Sessions' name in the title. It's called Sonnet for Desiree Ferruz, Prosecuted for Laughing at Jeff Sessions' Confirmation Hearing. And it has an epigraph from Senator Richard Shelby, which is Jeff Sessions extensive record of treating all Americans equally under the law is clear and well documented. And so this is the poem. America, I'm laughing, can you hear me? I'm laughing when I heard you say you weren't racist because you shared a hotel room on more than one occasion with a black lawyer. I'm laughing while you worked to keep him from voting. Can you hear me when I heard you say you liked the KKK until you learned the night smoke pot? I'm laughing, America, when I heard you say it was good news for the South. You are, America, good news for the South. I'm laughing when I heard you say that. After the Supreme Court broke the Voting Rights Act, please tell it again, America. Tell me the one I'm living.
Thank you. And that's also from the same manuscript?
Yeah, that's from the same manuscript.
Yeah, that's also a very powerful poem. Is there anything you want to say about that poem?
Well, as I said, hopefully it's more or less clear, but once I wrote the first Donald Trump poem, it became easier eventually to do others, and they tended to follow a particular pattern in that Trump would say or do something, and I would just sort of right away, I would take that and start writing a poem based on it. Sometimes I would actually use the thing that he said, or I should say Trump or people associated with what's going on with regard to Trump. And I would start writing a poem. This one, obviously, the epigraph was from Richard Shelby, not Trump. Mostly they're from Trump. But, I ended up responding directly and putting in the poems directly and straightforwardly things having to do with the particular political situation right now.
And I'd love to hear one more. I know you have one more for us before we go. Can you tell me a little bit about that, or just the title, and read it if you'd like?
Yeah, I can do another one. Let me hop over to it. Early on when I started writing them, as often happens if I've started in on a sequence of things, I get really excited and I start a few things all at once, and then maybe things tend to get piled up and I can't finish them. And so this one, and actually, the Sessions one too, it was one that I wasn't able to finish the way that I usually finish, where usually I'll write a poem and, it's one sitting. Usually, like, I sit down and write it. But plenty of times it takes longer than, it takes a couple days or weeks or it's months or years sometimes. And for this one, the one I'm going to read, which is called Display Food, working on it was, it probably was a few months ultimately. The beginning came sort of right away, but I couldn't figure out how to do the ending in the right way. I wrote several endings, and I kept thinking it was finished, but it took me months to really get to what it turned out was, I think, the ending of it. So as I said, it's called Display Food. It has an epigraph from Donald Trump, which was from the primaries, when he said, "We won with poorly educated. I love the poorly educated." And this is, like I said, this is called Display Food. America, the lights along the highway. At night, the street lights look just like the eyelets at the edge of the tarp behind which Kim Jong-un himself detains the sun, America. From you, I drive beneath them seeking you. And in what other country, America, could I within the country seek the country and find it nowhere? But the citizens are told in the citizens the country fails. America, I am becoming white in the white light, in flashes, no one knows. And still for every inch my afro grows, I wait a minute longer at the Walmart deli, but I find the real you there, where what you see will not be what you eat.
Thank you. I love that poem. That's as you began reading it too, I I don't know how many in the manuscript are like this, but it's so kind of, I don't know how to put this, but sonically memorable, this idea of America, 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 you know, as something you're kind of beseeching and asking of and curious about. In that use, maybe we can talk about just in this poem of America, America. And, you know, of course, we've heard that in past poets. There's some poems that come to mind for me that are very powerful about it, you know, America. So I'm thinking of Eileen Miles and in her poem about wanting to be the president and, you know, and this is who I am, America. But that was quite a different take she had on it. Your relationship with America as a Black American is also, especially in this poem, is being highlighted, right?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, the poem I tend to think of, even though he's by no means one of my favorite poets, is Allen Ginsberg's America, which used to sort of, I used to be, when I was writing these, I was very conscious, you know, that I'm sort of repeating Ginsberg's strategy, but I don't, you know, I was willing to allow that it was something that, you know, could be repeated. So this poem, you know, when I was writing it, I'm not sure how conscious I was of it. I moved to New York City from Oberlin, Ohio in August. And so this poem was from when I lived in Oberlin. And looking at it now, although I wasn't super conscious at the time, it's a poem that I actually don't think I could have written living in New York. And there are a couple reasons for it. One of them is that, you know, New York doesn't have Walmarts, but this was a specific thing that happened to me at Walmart. But in Oberlin, that's sort of the only grocery store to go to. But also, you know, in New York, I don't have a car, whereas when I lived in Oberlin, there's a lot of spaces, lots of empty space between lots of small towns. And so, you know, you do a lot of driving at night. The roads are, the highways and the roads are particularly dark. So writing this poem, I was thinking, I suppose in particular, about my relationship with that place. Also, I guess it is, the poem is sort of an expression of that place, even though I wasn't consciously written in that way. So that, you know, when it begins driving under the streetlights, that's, you know, for one thing, I don't drive anymore. And so that's, you know, that's only because I was living there that I wrote it. Although, you know, Kim Jong-un and his, you know, his role as a sort of supervillain, that hasn't really disappeared. But everything else, I mean, and, you know, even though it's about a particular Walmart and me standing at a particular deli, I think it's sort of expressive of pretty common things about being Black in America, things that, while they still happen in New York, you see them a little differently. Then, you know, that they're a little bit less apparent, or apparent in different ways, I should say, not less apparent, than they are when you're living somewhere in a small town where they are maybe, you know, that, well, they're expressed in different ways. They're expressed at the Walmart deli counter, which I guess I had thought was a sort of universal place until I came here and realized that they don't have them here.
Right, that's interesting. Before we go, I also want to ask you a little bit about your education and next moves. I know you graduated from Harvard Law School with what I understand is a law degree, and
yes,
and also an MFA from University of Iowa. How do those things come together? Is that for teaching or how will, both of those are, you know, very interesting degrees to me. I'm just wondering how that relates to your poetry or life or career.
Well, Iowa came about because, you know, I mean, I had wanted to be a poet since I was a teenager. I started writing when I was 15, and I think I settled upon it as what I was going to do with my life maybe when I was about 16. And although early on I was under the influence maybe of the wrong sorts of critics, and in particular, I had gotten this idea from a few books I had read that I shouldn't go to an MFA program. That was the last thing that I should do.
But that was bad for a poet somehow, you mean?
Yeah, and so what I was doing was I was going to major in philosophy, and I wanted to go to graduate school and get a PhD in philosophy, although early on that began to seem very unattractive because I knew that I would have to write a dissertation, and I didn't want to do that. I didn't know that I could. It seemed, in a lot of ways, sort of beyond me. Fall of my senior year, I guess it was October, I suddenly decided that now I should get an MFA, and I sort of rushed everything together. I didn't even have enough original poems, I had like 7, so I did some translations for my application and stuff. It was sort of a mess, and initially I wasn't going to apply to Iowa, but my mentor, a poet named Lex Runciman at Linfield College, he encouraged me to do so. And so I did fly to Iowa, and I got in somehow, and I went. And law school came about for different reasons. I'm really glad that I went to law school. I'm particularly glad that I went to Harvard, both because it gave me, I got to see things I don't think I would have seen at other law schools unless I'd gone to somewhere like Yale or something. But also because I got to work with Joy Graham, which was really wonderful. I got to take classes at a class at the Episcopal Divinity School, which is near there, which is really wonderful. When I first started going to Harvard, I went because I thought I needed a job eventually. And since I didn't have a book, and I didn't have a book coming, because I wasn't writing the poems that ended up being in my first book at all. And by the time I got my MFA, it was apparent that I would need a book to get a job. And I thought, well, if you go to like Harvard or Yale or whatever, everybody gets a job when they graduate. And so that seemed like a reasonable path. But it wasn't, my heart was never really in it. There were certain things about it that I found exciting and interesting. Law school, it wasn't really for me. I'm glad I did it. I'm glad I graduated. But it's not something that doesn't occupy a lot of my time. I don't think about it much. And like I said, I went to Iowa just because I wanted to be a poet. I didn't really know. I think when I started, I don't even know how much I was thinking.
And so now, do you practice law at all? Has that? I mean, that sounds like a very practical way of going to school. You know you'll get a job graduating Harvard with a law degree, but no, you're not practicing law or using that.
No, I teach it. I teach at Columbia, not law. I creative writing. So now I don't have anything to do with it. The only connection to my law degree now essentially is debt. I don't use it for anything. Although, like I said, it's nice. I'm glad I went. I'm glad I, but it's not something that's like part of my daily life.
I want to ask you the last question about what you're reading now, but is there anything you want to say before we go? Is there anything I didn't cover in talking about the your work, or is there a date for the manuscript coming out that you want to mention? Anything at all?
Well, no, I mean, no, because I haven't exactly announced the book yet or anything like that. You covered everything fine. So as I said before we started recording, what I'm reading is, it always makes me nervous, partly because, in some ways it's always aspirational, partly because, I don't want it to suggest, it feels so representational. And to me, what I'm reading is always, it's so in flux, and I'm always reading so many different things at once. I have been reading the Michael Wolff book, Fire and Fury, and today I'm probably going to start the transcript of the interview with Glenn Simpson, the Fusion GPS thing. Although I might just read the whole thing. It's like 300 pages, but it's like testimony and stuff, and that's really easy. It's super fast. And I've also been I'm reading Margaret Atwood's Alias Grace, which I, you know, I've never early on I read Margaret Atwood's poetry and I loved it, but I'd never read a Margaret Atwood novel ever. And so I've been reading that, and you know, a bunch of other things. I've been interested lately. I find myself interested in poets a lot. Sometimes in a sort of oppositional way. Like I've always had, like I, for years, I've had this very like kind of struggle, I guess, wrestling match with Derek Walcott. But I've been interested a lot lately in Cynthia Zarin, who. It's not really a struggle at all. I just really like her work. But, you know, I find, weirdly maybe, often enough, just like reading poems that I like, it's not enough of a reason. I instead want to figure out, like poets like Seamus Heaney, I keep going back to and I can't quite figure out why. I mean, I know that Seamus Heaney is a really a great poet, but I've only been grabbed sort of immediately by a few of his poems, but there's something about his work that keeps drawing me. And so I guess I'm kind of, and also I want to, I'm about to start in on this history of the king, the royal family in England in the, from I think it's the 11th to the 13th century. There's a time period I'm finding myself increasingly interested in.
Shane, I want to thank you for talking to me today. It's been a pleasure hearing about your reading as well as your work, your poems, and what you're working on. Thank you so much for sharing that with us.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.